Welcome to the 2023 series of the Property Report podcast by Property Guru, and thank you for tuning in to the first part of the award series. This time around, we will be focusing on the themes surrounding our 2023 Property Guru Asia Real Estate Summit, which will be held in Bangkok, Thailand this December. To begin the series, here's a fun fact. In 2023, more than half of the world's population, 4.5 billion, now live in cities, a figure expected to rise to 7 billion by 2050. The future of humanity will clearly be urban, so our challenge will be to ensure cities will be livable. Now, with me today to talk about this topic are our guests. Property Guru's own Dr. Nigeia Lee, Head of Real Estate Intelligence Digital and Software Solutions. And we have Mr. Stephen Ohm, Value Management and Specialist, Sustainability Advocate, Managing Director at Quantum Thailand, and the Chairperson of the Property Guru Asia Real Estate Summit. Hello, gentlemen, and welcome to you both. Before we start, please, can I ask each of you to tell us a little more about yourself?
Hi, everyone, and thanks, Tina, for the kind introduction. I'm Nigel. I'm the head of real estate intelligence, and my role is really doing research, market-related research, applied research on the latest market trends in different markets that we serve, including Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam, and also working with different associations and think tanks to come out with very interesting research that are pertinent to what we, the challenges that we are facing today and beyond. Thanks.
It's great to see you both, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you at RS 2023 on the 8th of December. My name is Stephen Ohm. I'm a value management and sustainability consultant. I work globally, although I have been based in Asia for the last 5 years. Currently, I'm on assignment in Dubai, which is very exciting. And prior to that, I was in the UK. It's amazing being able to travel again and really explore the cities again post-COVID. And I think, you know, we're going to be discussing that today. And it's really exciting. I'm really looking forward to the discussion.
Now, gentlemen, our first question is for Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee, you call yourself a real estate futurist. Can you expand on what that means?
Yeah, it first started off when, you know, LinkedIn asked us to put a title besides ourselves to attract content. So when I was thinking about this, is we are always looking forward from an urban planning profession about what is going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years and plan the kind of infrastructure that can last until that point in time, and then rethink about how we can fine-tune it. And I think this is the challenge that we have today, where things are moving so fast, but the physical infrastructure, you know, takes time to achieve its objectives. So for us as a profession, from an urban planner point of view, is how then can we look forward 10 years later? What is the kind of environment that we want to live in? What is the kind of environment that we want our children, future generations to live in, to thrive in the cities of tomorrow? So that has been largely the kind of personal challenge I took upon myself, be it in my job or the way I look and comment about the markets today and beyond.
Now, at a recent count, there were more than 30 urban livability indexes produced worldwide and more than 500 measures and benchmarks comparing cities. Clearly, there is a great deal at stake in the measurement or mismeasurement of quality of life. Can I ask you both, what do you think makes a city livable in the 21st century?
Dr. NJ, please go first. I'm very interested. I think the work that you do and the research that you're doing is really great. I'm really looking forward to having this discussion.
Okay, sure. When I start thinking about livable, right, there's a lot of ideas there and there's a lot of definitions there. So the one that I like most is, like, you know, there's kind of freedom of the residents within the city, how they could achieve their dreams, whether, you know, be it from a personal point of view, from a professional point of view, and how the whole environment actually helped them do that. Because what happened is we do not realize that actually how we are going to live our lives is actually largely entrenched in our environment. For instance, like happiness, right? We think that happiness is something that you can gain from how you interact with people, your friends. But the friends, the engagement, the enjoyment, sometimes is also very closely correlated with the distance. We've seen people feeling a kind of despair when they are living very far away from their workplaces. Because, you know, sometimes when people want to take care of their kids meeting some problems, but they can't go home to take care of them from work because of the traffic jam, from the distance to work, and that impact on their happiness. And there have been studies correlating those things, like distance to travel, to, you know, the outcome of children. So there's so many things that, you know, by controlling the urban environment, we can actually elevate the quality of living. But it's not as simple as it thinks, because there's always the market forces that is driving, you know, how the cities look like. So there's a balance of both. How are we going to balance that? And so that drives me thinking more and more about livable, like how do we curate the best environment to ensure well-being in every sense, while ensuring that, you know, in the long-term objectives are being achieved. And one of the key parts here is how do we balance that commercial objectives that always seems to run contrary to what we want, but actually could be aligned. You know, we do see people willing to pay more to stay in a green building. We do see people willing to pay more to stay in a very livable city. When we think about livable cities, they invoke feelings of happiness. That's why people are willing to pay a premium. So that is a really commercial, viable commercial runway towards having a sustainable and livable environment. It's just that how do we make it such that it's aligned with the long-term objectives and the short-term commercial objectives? And I do see there's a way to align both. So that is where I'm, you know, from my side, driving research to kind of, you know, marry these things, these two seemingly contrary forces into one. And I think that is the key to really drive conversation, how we can do that together. Stephen, what do you think? You know, you have been doing sustainability.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, I'm very biased, of course, because I have a very strong sustainability viewpoint and focus. But as time has gone on, I've realized that the sustainability, when we look at the four pillars, the environmental one, a lot of people focus on and think of sustainability as being the environment, as in the physical environment and the quality of air and all of those types of aspects. But as you said, it is the real estate sector, the built environment, that defines a lot of what happens immediately today, but also our interaction with our families and friends, with our work, with our communities, in profound ways. And I think that the way that people are viewing cities and urban migration and global mobility, etc., is really changing a lot. And as Tina was talking about the move from the rural to the urban at the beginning of this podcast, now initially I thought back in 2007, and I remember speaking about this in 2007, that was the first time that man went from into 50% or more in relation to the urban environment. But now, looking back, we're not sure if that's true. And I think Tina might be right. In the actual fact, that shift now to 50% is actually happening right now. And why is, how could that be true? How could both be true? Or how could we look at this? And it's because we're looking at what a city is differently. And before, it was easy in 2007, not that long ago, it was easy to sort of, you know, say something about a city and say a metric, but we hadn't actually really defined what a city was. if you define a city as just population of, say, 500,000 people, there are over 1,000 in the world. If you define it a city as over 50,000 people, then there are over 10,000 cities in the world. You know, where do we draw the line? And of course, the line should not be drawn just in terms of population, or definitely now in the era post-COVID, we shouldn't even draw it necessarily in relation to that we live within a specific boundary of a city. It's now not so much a geographical location, it's the city that we're linked with. And we may spend one day a week in that city and spend the rest of our week remote in a satellite from that city, not far away, but those types of things. And of course, you know, we all travel much more and all of those types of things. So really defining what a city is at the basic level is now happening, and it's still an open debate, a healthy, great debate. And then of course that leads all the way through to policy and regulation, even to the vision of cities, which Dr. Njie, you touched on. It's the vision of what cities can be, and that they're not going to be defined by what we were looking at even 5 years ago, let alone 10 and 15 years ago, is truly exciting. In terms of livability, and coming back to my point of sustainability, when we're looking at the environment and we're looking at the financial sustainability, which is incredibly important, but then of course the other two pillars really come to the fore, and that's the human pillar and the societal pillars. And they are becoming so much greater in our thinking about the built environment. We were really thinking about maybe two pillars mostly. Probably first, the financial. Second, the environment. And then the human and the social, they were there, but not really defined and focused on. I think that's changing.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Especially when we see, you know, nowadays the polarization of the societies is becoming more and more clear, and, yes, and becoming a very dangerous thing to have. And we see that countries are grappling with all these conflicts, you know, and there's not enough communication. So it's very interesting. You really bring up the right point, you know, Stephen, that, you know, this human aspect is becoming very, very key today.
Yes. And it's a great opportunity as well, because the cities that are going to be the ones that flourish and change their name, but I don't mean their name, but change everything that they're about and become the livable cities of the future, I don't think they're in the top 10 right now. And I think in the Asia Pacific region, and especially in Asia, it is, the opportunity is incredible. At a government country level, at a city level, of course, and also very much at a business level and a community level and an individual level. And I think it's very exciting.
Yeah. And talking about livability indices, one of the challenges is like, where do we get the data, right? And how do we standardize the data? And that is one of the challenges, and why we are seeing so many different type of indices catering to different needs, because some of this data could not be really, you know, came from objective sources. So people use surveys. So it really depends on who is more willing to give surveys. And at times you have certain groups that are missing in this sample, like, for instance, elderly people. It's very difficult to, you know, find elderly people who are most of the time, there's in some parts of the world where, you know, the elderly people do not get very good education because of how the, you know, the growth of the country is. And so doing surveys is very difficult, and we end up getting the quality of life or the livability indices based on a very narrow segment. So I think that is why we see a growth in terms of livability indices as more data are becoming available, especially big data.
Yes.
I love the interaction, gentlemen. Speaking of data, how do we ensure that rankings align with the public interest and help those in positions of leadership better understand the huge array of data they have access to?
Tina, this is very interesting. I think data always cuts both ways, right? Especially now with AI. There's the danger of how do we manipulate the data or use the data to actually advance certain groups' interests instead of others. But at the same time, data can be used very effectively, efficiently. It helps us to allocate resources to where it's needed. And I think a lot of energy should be put in the first part and how to ensure that we minimize people from manipulating the second part, just the former part where, you know, data is to further their own interests. So I think transparency is definitely one thing. So how do we allow people to use more data in a more transparent way, provide data freely, but at the same time, gated at the same time, because we do not want people to feel threatened, to still have that right of privacy. So that's that kind of balance that we need. And actually, in today's world, we could see that some of them, they use a black box where, you know, data is being fed into, processed, and then analyzed, and then we see the output. So in other words, there's better protection of individual privacy data, private data. So those things are actually at works. We have seen it working in, like, during when they are doing the COVID, when people wanted to know how does, you know, COVID spread, what are the measures needed to control the spread of COVID. So, but all these medical records are, you know, very sacrosanct and private information that you don't want them to leak out to the public space. So there's a lot of ways to overcome all this while doing very good research and coming out of good indices. So I think the key part here is how do we anonymize the data properly? How do we ensure the integrity of data? It's very important. And we are seeing the government coming in very strongly from developing nations to developed nations on how to deal with such data, especially the sensitive data.
That's right. Dr. NJ, I so agree with you. The importance of quality data, the integrity of it and the transparency of it is so important. And I think we've seen that in the sustainability movement, you know, which has been out for over 20 years now. And unfortunately, a lot of the data, a lot of the discourse and communication about sustainability is unfortunately greenwashing. And that greenwashing now is turning into a new phrase, which is an awful phrase, of green lashing, that backlash to sustainability. And it's a serious threat. And exactly that same pathway can go in relation to the proliferation of data. And as you mentioned, with AI, etc., there's going to be even more data around, but the quality, integrity and transparency of that data, that's a challenge. And it's really, really important.
How do you see the concept of livability evolving in the face of climate change? Who would like to answer first?
Dr. NJ?
Thanks, Stephen. I think climate change, right, I think is really the game changer here, actually, in a lot of ways. We have seen how climate change really brings senses to people. In the past, I would say in the past 20 years, when I first started doing some research in sustainability, when I was still an undergraduate, there's a lot of studies being done at that point in time, but nobody really take it very seriously. As in, they feel that it's good to have, but, you know, we still have a long runway. But now I feel that this climate change, you know, we are seeing the effects and people are being forced to act in a good way. Because if we don't do anything, we can see the consequences now. And it's very real. But the problem I see is that, you know, how do then make sure that it's not a segmented kind of approach where, you know, we only do a bit here, but, you know, we just leave it the rest. Or how do we have a more global strategy? So I think it impacts livability in a lot of ways. For instance, in the past, you know, the poor will tend to locate near the, you know, stay in not so desirable locations, near employment centers. And one of the things they don't really take into focus are whether the place is actually flood prone. In fact, they tend to move in when it's a dry season, you know, pay very high prices. But when there's flood, not only do they suffer damages, they also suffer valuation losses because the property no longer value as much. So there's all this kind of things that are ongoing, and that impact on the families, the property owners, very in many ways, of course, besides loss of lives and property. So I think with climate change, it brings a lot more kind of scrutiny into a lot of what we think is livable. In the past, we just feel that maybe, you know, you have a sea view that is livable, you know, because having sea view, according to research, help to improve your mental well-being. But at the same time, you're more susceptible to also flood risk, you know, especially with sea level rising. So there are all these things that are being, you know, interlinked and intertwined. But it also means that, you know, the importance of having some form of sustainability indices, some form of body ensuring, championing sustainability movement, because people couldn't see the immediate effect. Now they could see. And we need these bodies to continue their efforts to ensure that people adhere to, because we are having this existential threat. So I really believe that, you know, when we think about sustainability and livability, they are really intertwined concepts. And it really amplifies or worsens each of these things that we are talking about. And it's very important that when we think about both, they must be think together at the parallel. Yeah. What do you think, Stephen?
Yes, I really agree with you. And I do think that climate change is very pivotal in the way that people are thinking, conceptualizing, visualizing, and taking action. And whilst the United Nations, you know, first had the Conference of the Parties for Climate Change, the first one was nearly 28 years ago, I think in some ways the momentum for how we're really going to address these issues is only just starting to really where the rubber hits the road, where it goes from talking and intention and pledges, etc., and now it's coming down into hard actions and hard consequences. And I think that how we respond and adapt to the climate change factors is really starting to happen right now. There's a very healthy, I think, discussion in relation to differentiating the global north and the global south. No longer is climate change one solution has to fit all countries, all economies, and all peoples. That was never the case, but that was very often the language that was used. And that's really changing now. And I find that extremely healthy and with a lot of opportunity, which is really great. The discussion around climate change for the first time, where people are talking very strongly about the business case, the business mindset, not that it's just a business responsibility, but also that it can be really smart business and all of those types of factors. And I think that's bringing business and sustainability and response to climate change and our governments and NGOs much, much closer, where they really can look at the win-win-win for all the parties, and that how that is going to be different in different geographies. I think it's very exciting. I think it is pivotal.
A lot of information for me to digest. Gentlemen, before we end this episode, may we have a quick message from the chairperson of the 2023 Property Guru Asia Real Estate Summit on what we can expect at this year's event?
Well, I'm really excited. 8th of December in Bangkok, Asia Real Estate Summit is happening. This year's theme is Powering Communities. And it's very exciting for all of the reasons that we've been discussing today. We have central themes of how we live, how we work, and how we thrive. And the thrive is not just how we thrive as countries and cities, but also how do we thrive as businesses and communities and families and as individuals. It is so intertwined with the built environment. What we do next year and the experience that we have next year is defined by our built environment. And of course, being in the sector, what we build next year is going to define people's environment in 3 and 4 and 5 years' time, and the children and the children's children. And just with that language, you can see how intertwined the built environment is and sustainability is and how it defines our future. And it's really exciting. We have speakers coming from all over the world. Please look at the Property Guru Asia Real Estate Summit website for all the information. It's exciting, and we'll see you soon.
Dr. NJ, definitely great seeing you. Same with you, Stephen, and I'll see you in December in Bangkok. Thanks for tuning in to the special series of the Property Report podcast by Property Guru. We have exciting topics lined up, so stay tuned for the next ones. And for more information, visit asiarealestatesummit.com. See you then.